Welcome to Parallel Lines. This is episode 13. Unlucky for some, but it won't be for us. And we've got another wonderful special guest, haven't we, Tony?
And in preparation for this, last night I watched an episode of When the Boat Comes In, just so I could get into tune with the accents. James Bolam giving it the full thing.
Hopefully Tony's going to behave and not just take the mick out of us this whole episode. But
get it out of your system now.
Yeah. Regular listeners will have heard the trailer for this, which was our episode at the Women in Rail Awards, where we bumped into the wonderful Jenny Dempsey. Welcome.
Hi, you all right?
Oh, she's gone all shy now.
She's gone posh.
She's gone all posh now. Have you got your Kathy Secker voice ready for us, Jenny? Have you got your elocution lessons at the ready to tack our posh on the radio?
Yes, I'll start off with my telephone voice, and then by the end of it, it'll be all RB the same pet.
Excellent.
I can just say, by the way, I once did an interview on Radio Wales, and for some reason, I said my first sentence with a Welsh accent and it was live. So I had to gradually wind out of it as I was talking. I said, oh, hello there.
Sometimes it's hard not to slip into the accent of somebody else. Anyway, so Jenny, please introduce yourself for us.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Jenny Dempsey. I'm the Managing Director at Diamond Rail Services. That is a small SME based in Sheffield. And we do train refurbishment, specialising in seat overhaul.
Lovely. So, yeah, we have on Parallel Lines talked about how trains are specified, designed, built, and then we've talked about how day-to-day they're delivered on the network and kind of looked after from a maintenance perspective. So today we thought we'd talk about a bit that maybe people don't hear about that much, to be honest. I'm not sure many people really think about what you guys do at Diamond Rail. So we'll dive into that in a minute, but we want to know about you first because we're all about the people. So tell us a bit about you, Jenny.
Well, as you can hear, I am from South Shields originally, and I'm not losing the accent. I'm with you today from Huddersfield, and I've been there for 18 years now, so that's not...
That's home.
It is, yes.
How did you get into all this then? What was the thing that got you into rail? What did you study something, train as something that links into all this, or is this a swerve in your career at some point? Was your career always going in this direction? What do you know about...
Well, I'm sure a lot of people will say this, but I got into rail by accident.
We love a random railway career story.
I went to Northumbria University and did psychology, so was very interested in people from school and really enjoyed that psychology degree. I was also working at John Lewis at the time, and they
Jenny. I worked at John Lewis. No, in Nottingham. I worked in the Nottingham branch.
Oh, okay. Mm. I know loads of people have worked through John Lewis, and they put me through my management training whilst I was at university. Oh. So I was on this retail management course, and that was what I was applying for. And I widened my search because it was right in the recession in 2008. And I, through a website, put in retail manager, and I was looking in the Leeds area at the time, and retail service manager came up for cross-country trains. And reading that as a description, not being from in the industry and seeing like it was a very attractive salary as well, I thought, oh, that must be chief trolley dolly. I'll go for that. And I was successful to get that role working out of Leeds and cross-country. I see people from there all the time now, like from... Because it was such an incredible job travelling the country and meeting all the train crew, the drivers, the managers, the first class hosts. And people have moved about in the industry. Yeah. And we say it's a small world, but yeah, I still see train managers in new roles. And
cross country, it never leaves you. So I was cross country's account manager, funny enough, around the same time, actually 2008. And some of my best friends on the railway are from that time. And in, subsequently, when I've been talking to graduate trainees and, you know, people applying to be on the railway, I always say if you get an opportunity to work for or with cross country, same kind of applies for freight, actually. Take it because you learn so much because cross country goes everywhere, sees everything.
Yeah.
You know, like you get to go on nearly all the network rail routes. You get to go through so many major stations. The only thing they haven't got is stations. That's the only thing with cross country that you miss out on a little bit. But otherwise, oh my God, you just learn so much. And the people you meet, and they never leave. They just move around. They just seem to go to other places. So I'm so pleased you found the same thing. Sorry, continue.
Yeah. And being Leeds based, I mean, we did Edinburgh runs and then we also had to shift Leeds to Plymouth. So it was a 13-hour day and you were on the same train and people would come on and go off. It was hard work. And I think when I applied thinking that it might have some managerial responsibilities, like maybe looking after a team, which is what I wanted to do. And I sharp found out that it wasn't the job that I'd thought it was. And also I got travel sick.
Oh, yeah, working on a Voyager for 13 hours, feeling a bit queasy, that's not great,
one
is it?
Edinburgh, on them curves. Like, I used to have to wear the bands with the pressure points in.
I've got them, because I can't do it either. The only time I've ever served food on a train was the launch of the 350s. Do you remember, Tony, when we launched the 350s on TPE? And I got roped into serving the inaugural journey food along with some other people. And oh my God, I've never felt so sick. And I was like, I could not do this. I don't know how the West Coast people do it with the tilt and everything. Mm. Oh, no, thank you.
Yeah. Well, there was that. And also my back was really sore, because you know I'm a tall girl, and the hot water urns back then were 22 stone. The whole trolley with the hot water urn in was 22 stone.
Oh my gosh, wow. That's so, like pushing around a rugby player.
Hanging on to that on Tiverton, when you go down the Tiverton curves at the bottom, you were like,
how do they do it? You see some really small catering hosts.
You just wedge in the seats, and then the seats need extra work when they're refurbished. We get onto
back to that.
Because they've had 22 stone trolleys bashed into them to stop them from running down the aisle.
Yeah, but keep it coming.
Yeah. We'll come back to that later then.
So I actually only did that job for 1 year, but I did enjoy the people side of it and all of the advantages to working on the railway, particularly liking to travel myself. The balance, work-life balance with it. So, but I left and I went back into retail management. I was a store manager of Greggs, of Home Bargains. And then I had my daughter in 2014. And I decided that I needed a job that was more for me in that balance. You know, kind of working on Christmas Eve and having to go in by 10 p.m. on a retail estate. It was hard
and really inflexible, right? It's like, it is what it is, retail, isn't
really
it? And there's not much flexibility.
So I started searching, and there was a part-time job came up at Huddersfield booking office. Mm-hmm. So when my daughter was one, I got the job there. I actually sat in that interview and told them I wasn't leaving until I got the job, because it was so perfect for us and I wanted to be back. And I was working with Trans Pennine.
Wow.
I can imagine you doing that. Will Munton. Like, I am not leaving this room until you give me a job.
Yeah, I was just like,
Wow.
And then I've got a few jobs that way, actually.
Be warned if she ever applies. If you're out there in the industry and you ever get an application from Jenny, just bear in mind, if you're not thinking about giving her the job, don't invite her to the interview, because otherwise it's going to be a long day.
So I did that for a year. Then I went to work at Northern as their customer experience manager. That was where I got to work with Dan Edwards. Dan Edwards was one of the best bosses I've ever had. Yeah. He was so flexible, inclusive, supporting, and really was my cheerleader, and still is today when I get messages from him. And did that for a few years. I did loads of random projects at Northern because I was on a secondment that you haven't seconded from anything.
A never-ending secondment. There's a lot of those on the railway.
Yeah. Like a mug, I think, is what in the time. I was just saying yes to anything. So I did Star Mobile training for conductors. Mm-hmm. I did a Proud to Be Northern campaign in 2016, telling all the train crew how Northern were going to invest their money. That was a challenge. uniform rollout.
Oh, that's the project that nobody ever wants. Uniform and badges. Nobody ever wants to do.
So I'd done all these like little miniature projects just through being an organised person, I feel. And then the job came up for Fleet Refurbishment Project Manager. Mm-hmm. And I went for it. And my boss at the time, Andrew Marden, he said that he really stewed over what to do about it. And he decided that he did need a non-engineer in the role because he had a lot of engineers. And he tells me to this day it was a risk. And he feels like it paid off. The first 3 months were awful. It was very much sitting in rooms, not knowing anything what was being said. So I had to learn really quickly.
It's like a whole different language, right?
Oh, gosh. I remember being in a meeting about signage on the inside of a train and whether the exit arrow should be up or down? And I'm like sitting going, does it matter? Like, up.
Like, there's people dying elsewhere in the world of hunger and war, and does the arrow need to be up or down?
And I'm already thinking, shouldn't it be left or right anyway? But there we go.
Well, this is it. Am I going to go through the ceiling or down through the floor? No, I'm going to go through the door that's open. Yeah. So I remember thinking, oh, actually, I can bring something to this role because I am really decisive. So I went, right, it's up. There we go. I made a decision. And that was the first decision I made in that role.
And never looked back.
So we'll think of you every time now. Every time we see an up arrow, we'll think of you.
Yeah.
Thanks. I got a real confidence, and I actually had a mentor through Women in Rail. Catherine Oldale was my Women in Rail mentor at the time. And I had a real conversation with her around technical skills versus soft skills and people skills, if you like.
Yeah.
And our light bulb moment was, oh, I've got oodles of people skills, and that's what I'll bring to this role. So my confidence just really grew to challenge appropriately to build the relationships, which I think is what project management is all about. And it was a really interesting, successful project that I delivered. Then I ended up with Diamond Rail because they were a supplier. And I'd never worked in sales before, but again, I just assumed that it was a people-based role.
Yep.
And so it was selling something I'd learned for the last 4 years and was really passionate about and knew a lot about. So took the role there as business development manager and, started to talk.
I'm sure you found that really difficult, Jenny, because you're such a wallflower, aren't you?
I know. I did a presentation for Women in Rail a few years ago, and I actually dug out some of my old school reports. Yeah. And I put them on the screen. About four or five of them said, da 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 da, Jenny talks too much. Should be great. Talks too much. Talks too much.
It's so familiar.
But, so, well, it's worked for you though, hasn't it? So presumably you then rose within the ranks at Diamond Rail to the top.
Yes, yeah, screw you, Mrs. Ramsden.
And you are now the managing director, aren't you? So you're one of an elite group, really, of female managing directors in the rail industry, because there's not that many of them. You know, you can count on a few hands the actual number of female MDs, CEOs, you know, that really top level. There's not that many of you. So well done. First of all, just well done for getting there.
Thank you. I don't take stock enough of that achievement. And I think my age in the industry as well is a bit different and diverse. So I do reflect on that. And I'm not sure exactly how it was achieved, but I think just through always having a goal.
Yeah, it's that whole thing of, isn't it, just what you've described there with your CV is, again, stuff that I've said to younger people in their career over the years, just say yes, figure it out afterwards. Like, you know, and especially for women, because we're not always great at that. A man will look at a job description and think, oh, I can do about half of that and have a go. And, you know, we tend to hold back until we think we can do all of it. But yeah, figure it out. If you're good with people and you're interested in stuff.
Yeah, I think belief as well. Like, I joked earlier about not leaving that room. And then another one was going for the Proud to Be Northern role, and there was two roles. There was a lead facilitator and a facilitator, and the lady rang me to say, I'd like to offer you the facilitator role, and something immediately subconsciously came out of my mouth and went, that isn't the role I want, actually. I would like the lead facilitator role. Could we have a conversation? And she said, the feedback later was, you just saying that got you the job, because that challenge or that confidence in yourself was... And it was subconscious. Something went, no, I could do that. Yes, I can do that. Absolutely.
One of the skills that was needed for that role was to be confident and to be challenging and to take challenge. So, yeah, I see why they would say that. Oh, well, you're right for this job, because you're the type of person who would ask that question.
So with the Women in Rail hat on, just as you've mentioned that, do you think sometimes that the reason we haven't got quite as many female managing directors, chief executives, maybe, I mean, in TOC world, we haven't got as many as there were sort of 10 years ago.
True.
So it's gone backwards. Do you think sometimes maybe the opportunity has come up and they haven't said the right thing that shows an absolute confidence that they could do it? I haven't come here to be deputy managing director. I was thinking, actually, I wanted to be managing director. Oh, we didn't expect you to say that. Do you think possibly
I think
my aim is to be the top, not the number two or whatever?
Yeah, I think there's a statistic around belief and imposter syndrome that it is more prevalent in women than it is men. And I think that belief in standing up for yourself is huge to get into those kind of ranks and opportunities.
I think it's a dangerous combination between being a female and being British. You know, we're just too polite and kind of, you know, oh, I don't want to sound too full of myself. I don't want to sound too, you know, arrogant. Whereas if you think, if you take the gender thing out of the equation and say, if we were in America, you would go in and demand a job and say out and do it. And, you know, in a way that we're just not comfortable doing that here. And we should be. We should just back yourself.
So
should we get into trains now?
What do you do now? What is the company that you lead actually involved in doing?
So Diamond Rail Services has grown hugely over the last 4 years since we rebranded to Diamond Rail Services. And that was to encapsulate everything that we do on the inside of a train effectively. We'd always been a specialist of seat overhaul, so passengers and driver seats. And that would include when a train's up for its refurbishment or a rebrand, you would take all of the seats and their components and renew them. So that comes from foam, fire barriers, and the top covers. That can be a few different leather. It can include things like embroidery, fancy double stitching, and cross. Like there's lots of design features that we can complete. The more technical side is things like the functional mechanisms. So, you know, driver seats can be quite complicated with gas struts failing, and our engineers fantastic at reverse engineering those parts and making sure the driver's seats are functional and purposeful. So we expanded to do the whole of the inside of a train. It was kind of a little bit of what my old job had been, but I think it naturally fits for all the interdependencies. If you're taking out the seats, you need to do the floor. If you're painting the walls, then you need to consider all of the interdependent parts of a project. And so we offer and have delivered 2 fleet refurbishments to date, with others on the forecast as well. But the best one I can tell you about, a real example, was the 29-6 car class 395 units that we completed in May for Southeastern and Hitachi. And that was Diamond Rail running the project management, so all the labour on site. It was a complete strip of the unit, take out all the seats and put them somewhere, take up the old carpet and paint the inside with our paint partner, full interior repaint. We then put new carpet down, new lino. The seats were up at Sheffield, having their full refurbishment, new cushions. We also reverse engineered the metal pans, and we work with a big supply chain to be able to bring all this together, so the customer's got one point of contact. Then the seats went back in, had new labels, the grab handles were remolded with rubber, all the powder coating was done on the poles, and that was all done in 14 working days on a 6-car.
14 days per 6-car? Wow, that's a quick turnaround.
So did you do the thing? I've got loads of questions all coming up at once, and I don't know which order to do them in, but let's just start with them. Do you do the thing where you've got, once you start, you've got the stuff overhauled from one, ready to go on to the next? Or do you you actually just strip the train out? Because I've seen it done different ways, and sometimes they've started with one, taken the stuff out, and eventually you end up with putting it onto the next one, and the next one to keep the flow going. But on others, they take it out, do it, put it back in the same one.
I mean, that sounds like a complete luxury. There's seldom any spares. So, you know, you're processing the parts that have come out of that train. And because often they're coach built as well, you have to make sure that they go back in the same place. So traceability is huge. You know, it's going through a powder coating process. You must make sure that's traceable throughout. And with a program like that, there was no margin for errors that could have cost time. So it was super organized.
So we touched on this with the, when we were talking about maintenance with Stacey Thundercliffe and Rachel Stratton, they were very much talking about, you know, it's that thing, isn't it? Time is money. Availability is key to your customers, isn't it? So if you've promised them 14 days, you can't go over that, can you? Because that's trains out of service. That's customers, you know, not being able to travel. So it's big stakes, really, yeah?
Yeah. And then from the supply chain point of view and that, you ultimately, because that's such a risk to the industry and the operator, that's back down through contracts to be liquidated damages.
Yeah.
And so you're signing up to say, I can do this in this time frame. And, you know, there would be penalties if it wasn't.
So the interesting thing there is, as you were mentioning, the trains are designed to last for 30, 35 years or whatever. But in that time, even by the time they get to their first big refresh overhaul, manufacturers of components have gone bust or stopped making the bits or whatever. So that the reverse engineering is a key thing. Yeah. I mean, we've actually heard, you know, manufacturers going bust halfway through building a new train fleet. And then halfway through, they have to say, where do we buy the toilets from? Because they've stopped coming. But actually, when a train is, how old were the 395s then? Were they getting to 15?
They were out for the 2012 Olympics, so yes, they were.
13 years.
Yeah. Best part of 15. Yeah.
So,
but designed before that.
And this is first refresh.
Yeah, so again, we were talking about this, weren't we, saying like, even before the thing is built, it will have been designed, obviously, years before that. So that train is probably 20 years old, really, by the time you take into account the design life. Yeah.
And there's not many things you can go out and buy that are still made 20 years later that are exactly the same. So the reverse engineering thing is quite a good thing. If you can offer it, and having experienced people on the team who can look at something and say, I know how I can make something that'll work with that or replace that exactly or whatever. That's kind of a specialist thing, but is what you've got to be able to do if you're going to sell yourself to offer a service now, isn't it?
Of course, and we class it as one of our USPs. We've got an excellent engineer that works with us who can problem solve on that level. Because often, like you're saying, not just parts, but it's documents and data as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of policies only hold data, say, for 10 years. If you're a supplier, obviously train builds are like forever and their document control is more intense. But it's very difficult to find a specific drawing for a part that was 15 years old. And, you know, you're relying on a person at that point to, oh, yes, I did that drawing. I'll just get it out of me.
Yeah, my personal files. Yeah.
And is the advance in technology also handy here? Because I know on one fleet refurbishment, not one you did, but they were able to 3D print parts to replace them because they only needed 20 or 30 of them anyway. So it wasn't worth going to a manufacturer and saying, will you start production of this thing? And then they found that they could 3D print exact likenesses of. Now, you know, 20 years ago, nobody had heard of a 3D printer. So that wouldn't have been a solution then. So presumably as technologies come on, it is easier to reverse engineer or to create parts that would do something.
Yes, we've got a partner who does 3D printing for such things like that. And those quantities are where it really does help.
And I just want to talk about driver's seats for a minute, because this is
the best seat in the house,
the best seat in the best seat in the train, and driver's seats and driver's cabs more widely. Again, not something that everybody gets to see, you know, depending on where you are in the railway, you may never have had the joy of seeing a driver's cab, but there's a lot going on there and it is their place of work, isn't it? So it's really important that a driver, I mean, I know we take the mick, don't we, sometimes, and Tony and I are some of the people who take the mick out of them, but drivers are delicate flowers and, you know, they need looking after and, you know, mollycoddling sometimes. But at the end of the day, that chair that they sit on for a long period of time doing a demanding job where they need to be alert, responsive, you know, and they're in charge of hundreds of people behind them. Getting that right is a big responsibility, isn't it? That chair needs to be pucker.
Yes, and it comes with a lot of requirements for different fleets, for different... we actually did a piece of work around designing a footrest, and that was another glimpse into the requirements for all of the drivers, and we learned about all of the different percentiles of people using it. You know, you can imagine that you could have a 5 foot lady driving a train, but also a 6 foot six lady or gentleman driving a train
and with
everything in between,
and with different dimensions, and, shall we say
different weight and build requirements.
Well, I'm reminded of, I was just going to say, I'm reminded of a magazine editor who's no longer with us. So we were looking at a new train and he was quite a large bloke and he was moaning about how this new train seats were just completely wrong, didn't fit in them. And somebody in the room said, it's because you're massively out of gauge. And, I mean, it was the only way to get it through to him. I mean, he was way out of any of the percentiles. So, you know,
am I right in saying though that maybe I've dreamt this, one of you might correct me. Did there used to be a height requirement for train drivers? I know we've just changed the entrance age recently down to 18 from 21, but am I right in thinking it used to be like minimum 5'7" or something like that? I'm sure I've read that or heard that somewhere.
I know a 6'6" driver and I do know a 5-foot driver.
And nowadays, I'm sure that's true. I'm sure I've heard it. Listeners, let me know if I've dreamt this. Yeah. Somebody email in and correct me if I've totally made it up. But I'm sure, I mean, if you think about it, and there's probably a serious point in here, older units used to be more kind of...
Inflexible,
yeah. So, you know, like nowadays, a driver's seat, like you say, Jenny, when you're reverse engineering them, there's 1,001 different combinations of how high it is, how far back it is, the tilt, yes, the armrests. All the different components of a driver's seat have been, you know, developed over many years of consultation with ASLEF, predominantly the union, involvement of actual drivers. Their feedback has become, yes, really important in the design of those chairs. But I don't think that used to happen. And I imagine in the 60s, it was just you either fit or, yeah, you're uncomfortable, yeah, you know, yeah. Yeah. Basically.
Yeah. Adjustability is a huge thing. Like a lot of the designs now have been advanced to make them adjustable in every which way.
Yeah. Yeah. Recognizing that important kind of ergonomics piece about, you know, this is your, yes, place of work. And I'm just looking where in my office, that's my desk chair. It can be tilted, heightened, lowered or whatever. Well, that's my desk chair, but the equivalent for a driver is that chair that they're sat in.
It's, yeah, the same.
Yeah.
So do you, yeah, get a chance in pitching for these projects or whatever to give some input into what you might suggest, or are you very much given this is what we want? I'm thinking because a refurbishment, I'll be very careful how I don't identify the companies involved here. A refurbishment finished not too long ago and I noticed the bits of the seats are already falling off, and I raised it with the company who had done the refurb and they said, we told the operator that's not the design you want to go for, and the operator said, this is the design we're going to go for, and now the conversation is, well, we told you so, basically. And so what sort of input do you get when they arrive to discuss a project with you? Do you have the opportunity to say, are you sure that's the way you want to go? Is that the material you really want to use? Because there's been some stuff, hasn't there, with train seats in the last few years that they all went down one route. What did they go through? Was it the flat cloth? And they all said, we should have gone back. And they're all putting moquette.
Bring back,
back
the moquette.
Front, yeah, of the campaign for that, beating my drum.
So presumably now...
Managed to change Northern's fleet from flat cloth to moquette, yeah.
So do you have input in that then? Yeah. Or is it just a gentle nudge based on your experience?
No, we don't have input. You can absolutely, as you've said, Tony, you can say all of those things. Are you sure you want, like, need to make you aware of this? It's often mainly led by marketing. So if a certain brand needs to be fulfilled, then often the design's already been done with design houses and we will get renders. So then we're basically reversing what's looked at being computerized on a digitally to go, we would like the train to look like this. And I think you said earlier about the piece around, we're generally wanting to be helpful, people pleasing and saying yes. So you don't want to come from a supplier perspective, you don't want to come across as think all your ideas are rubbish. Yeah. So you're kind of trying to suggest, wouldn't put that curve there because you might get a wrinkle in the material, or if you use that leather, that colour leather, you might get pen marks all over it. Guess which fleet that is. Or if you can absolutely advise, and actually that becomes our caveats, which, yep, feels rubbish, but we do a process called a first article inspection. So for any project, we would create our version of the render and go, here it is. And then within the small print, you do have to put things like not responsible for the performance of the material, or,
yeah,
because if it's been chosen by the customer, it's very difficult to accept liability for that.
And I suppose budget comes into it a bit as well, doesn't it? Your customer's budget, because there's obviously the marketing thing. And I mean, I remember this on a particular project I was on years ago where the first renders from the marketing team/designers came back and the bottom of this train was white. you know, down to the soul bar. And the look on those of us faces in the room who were more operational, it was a picture because we all just went, really? And, you know, fortunately, that was earlier on enough in the project to be able to say, I don't think you really want the bottom half of the train to be right. I mean, I'm thinking of units that are. That yeah. There are some units out there, not the ones that I'm talking about.
They're nicely brown now, aren't they?
But they're not yeah. white anymore yeah. because with the best will in the world, of those course. Trains do not go through the wash plant often enough, and you will never be able to get them through often enough to keep that clean. But if that gets past the early design stages without somebody pointing that out, then it will go through, won't it? And that's what you're living with. The budget thing, though, I suppose yes. is a bit more... You might want something to look pretty, but if you can't afford it, I mean, that's the same as like doing your house up, isn't it? You know, I want to have a 5-star look on a 3-star budget. You know, you must come across that often with your clients, do you? Where the budget is what it is nowadays on the railway, isn't it? And you got to work with it.
Yeah, and it's our challenge to take render plus budget and create reality.
Yep.
You know, and that's the bit that you've then got to sell. And if that can not meet an expectation, then that's where it can become challenging for customer and supplier relationships.
Yeah.
But presumably, as things have gone on, you've seen trends changing as well. I noticed Chiltern are having all the carpet that was on the walls taken off, because when the trains were built for Chiltern in British Rail days that Chiltern are using, they're halfway up to the windows, will put carpet stuff on the walls.
I never really understood trendy, that.
But they say, oh, it dampens the noise and it has a feel of luxury about it. And then over the next 30 years, they've discovered it stinks to high heaven. You can't clean it properly and it's really foul. And they're going back now to a hard finish that's easy to clean and is bright and clean and fresh when it's been cleaned properly. So are you seeing trends now? Are you seeing people saying, I don't know why we ever did that in the first place?
That always reminded me of carpets in bathrooms. You know, like there's some things you just don't do.
Awful. Yeah. Awful design. Yeah. And it's such a horrible place to put chewing gum and, disgusting. I think not so much trends, but cycles. Like, I think we try, everything's got, like, pros and cons to it. So you do something like that, and what we'll do is we'll take all of the carpet off the day door panels now, and then in 10 years' time, things are like, oh, isn't it loud? Should we put some noise cancelling on? You'll forget that you took it off.
There was a reason why we got rid of that.
Yep.
Absolutely. You know, and I think in the UK, we seem to look a lot to Europe for solutions as well. Mm-hmm. That was where the flat cloth decision came from a designer who was like, oh, it's modern, it's European, let's go for flat cloth. And then it went into the industry and was like, oh, this doesn't clean very well, and trains are messy places. Slowly but surely, everybody seems to be moving away from that decision. But who knows in 10 years time if someone goes, oh, in this modern, shall we?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I would do, you know, in my benign dictatorship that, you know, eventually is going to occur, when I rule the world and I get to decide lots of things, I would ban, sorry, Jenny, Greg's pasties. I would ban Greggs from trains.
Oh, on the trains?
Yeah. Because, oh my goodness, have you ever been, like, for instance, when I worked at TPE, and obviously I travel on TPE a lot, in the ballroom, do you know the ballroom?
Yeah,
the ballroom of a 185, you know, the bit that's...
Between the toilet and the first class.
Between toilet and first class on a 185. For those who don't refer to it as the ballroom, everybody at TPE does. Well, that's also where the buggies go, isn't it? And where I come from, back to being a northern lass, that's referred to as an Ashington dummy, where I come from, at a Greg's sausage roll, because that's, you know, what you shove in the face of your toddler to shut them up. And it just ends up all over the carpet and gets trodden in. And then, you know, like you said, add a bit of chewing gum into the mix. And ban sausage rolls on trains. That would be my first law that I would pass.
First port of call.
And that is a thing generally, isn't it? People really don't appreciate when they're complaining that the seat isn't as bouncy as it used to be in the 1950s. I mean, partly because it's not stuffed with horse hair and spring, but, you know. I remember going across the Hope Valley once in one of the oldest trains, and it got the proper spring seats. They're about a foot deep. The whole, as it was going over, you can see me doing this, but the whole train was bouncing in unison. And I stood at the end of the carriage and just watched everybody going up and down about 6 inches. It was really impressive because they were absolutely in unison. And it was the days before a phone camera.
You should have filmed it and sent it to music, you know, to the like beat of the movement.
But people don't realise.
We did the Wensleydale Railway refurbishment, and they had seats like that, yeah.
And you can't use horsehair anymore,
can you? We do still see some of them.
Presumably you have to artificially replace...
It's a little bit less fire compliant than that.
funnily enough, yeah, doesn't meet the fire regs.
Yeah.
But people don't realise when they're sitting in a train seat how many, probably million bottoms it's going to have to cope with before you guys get to replace it. Or the carpet's got to cope with however many million people walking on it. You know, you'd never find a home carpet that would even remotely come close to the kind of wear that the train carpets get, or seats that you don't really think about it when you just get on your seat on the train, how many people might have sat down heavily on that seat in the years before, or squirmed around in it.
Want to think about that, do you?
No,
nobody wants to think about that. Yeah.
In coming up with solutions when you're pitching to do the work and everything, you're aware, you're creating something that is going to cope with millions of uses before it gets tweaked again. It's not like doing a bit of home furniture, is it?
Absolutely not. And then, like, talk about the challenges to an SME, you're then asked to sign up for warranties and, you know, make that last for at least 24 months. And you know, if you're going to send it round on a football train every Saturday, then yeah, you're kind of signing up to things that might not be achievable.
We were talking about this earlier, Jenny. That's a really interesting point about, yeah, you're signing up to things that are from outside of your control. Tony, that's another example of the railway never being in control of all the variables. You know, we were talking about lineside fires and saying, oh, you know, how is the railway ever supposed to protect against things that are totally outside of their control? And that's just yet another example, isn't it? Because you can build something, refurbish it really robustly, fit the most up-to-date, hard-wearing materials that have been installed by an expert, and you've sent it off your production line, you know, really happy with it. And you sign up to a warranty, but you don't know what they're going to let people do, what they, you know, what those passengers are going to put it through. Mm-hmm. It's harsh, isn't it, really, some of the stuff we sign up to.
And because we mentioned it right at the beginning in your early days when you were, you said the word trolley dolly, and I'm only using it because you used it. But those heavy trolleys are bashing into arms.
Yeah.
And you see these beautiful new trains. I was on a brand new one a couple of weeks ago, and I was thinking, isn't it a good job they don't have trolleys on this train, actually? Because those beautiful armrests are going to be slammed into. And I was on one the other day that does have trolleys, and it's only been refurbished a couple of years. And already those armrests are scored and scratched and chewed up and everything.
All parts of the train.
Yeah.
The vestibule, the doors, you know, if you go, they're difficult to control. And you end up with chunks out of everything.
Yeah.
That's a cheery thought.
No, but it's, I was going to say they're getting abused. They're not being abused, but they are.
Just used.
They're being used intently. And then somebody rolls up to you and says, can you make this perfect again? You know, and could you guarantee that it'll stay looking perfect for at least 2 years?
Yes. Yeah. And that is the challenge. And you often feel like you're not in the same reality conversation. So coming at it from because a reality conversation can be deemed negative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People don't want to hear about the real world, do they?
No, I go, well, no, not really. I can't really assume that stitch will stick. You know, you can't, like you said, it's, so you say, yes, no problem. Absolutely.
We should have some trains with fat panels on them that just says, look around you. This vestibule will have been hit by people carrying 1.5 million suitcases. It will have been hit 4 times an hour by a heavy catering trolley. And it's going to do this for the next 15 years before somebody takes it apart. That's why sometimes these trains look like they are, because they're doing a really, really tough job. They get used intensively. And somebody that gets on a train and says, oh, look at that scratch on there. Do you know what it's been through?
Mm-hmm. I don't think people would appreciate
that. And that's like,
that.
I'm just going to take the opportunity to sell for 2 minutes, because that is my biggest bugbear, because I think this type of refurbishment work should be more maintenance work and done little and often. Mm-hmm. You know, you wait for one refurbishment every 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years. And if it was done more frequently, like even if the trains went in once a year, you would have less to do and it would be less money in the long run if you stayed on top of it.
Right.
You kind of don't stay on top of it and you get past the point of no return and have to do something mega to change it. So that is something that I really beat the drum of and tried to get contracts for our front of house service to do it frequently.
And I suppose that would help better align expectations with reality as well, wouldn't it? Because if you make a big song and dance about something happening every 12 years and it's perfect and you've stripped it back to the bare bones, your expectations then are higher, aren't they? About, you know, I've effectively got a new train, really.
You need
But if you did it little and often, Yeah, you'd have a different expectation. So there we go. Calls.
It's so much easier to manage.
Yeah, calls for the new world to involve more little and often rather than this boom and bust thing, isn't it? Again, absolutely. That phrase that comes up so often. Just building on that then, let's move into the world now that you guys are an SME, as you explained. You're not a huge business, yes, in the context of there are some absolutely huge businesses that operate in rail. You know, we all know them, the Hitachis, the Siemens of this world. You know, they're multinational global corporations with a hell of a lot of money and workforce behind them. That's not you. You're the complete opposite end of the scale, aren't you? You're this lovely little SME from the north of England and very much embedded, yeah, in that whole kind of engineering heritage of Yorkshire, ex-steel kind of production territory and all that kind of thing. What's life like for an SME in the rail industry at the minute then? Well, just tell us a bit about the landscape for you guys.
It's never consistent. So the information that we get to help our planning is not consistent or readily available to us. And we'll constantly have conversations about things moving to the right. And what that means for an SME is much more detrimental than an operator or the large business, as you say. Something moving to the right for us means, right, we still want to retain all these staff, but that project moved. What should we do with that now? What can we have them busy with? Or it falls to the salesperson within the business to fill a gap, or it can be very challenging for all of the balance. So I think the foresight of projects coming up is quite poor. And there's some great associations out there that try to give us that, but they're not particularly accurate or consistent. Things can come online, they can go offline. You can do a lot of prep for something and then it doesn't come off.
Why is that so inconsistent with the work you do? Because I'm aware of that, and you know, we've seen the RIA, the Rail Industry Association, for instance, write into government about the pipeline and saying, you know, that it needs to be more visible and consistent. And I sort of get that with more like, let's say, heavy infrastructure-based projects, the traditional infrastructure projects where you're digging holes in the ground and what have you, because, you know, they can't get the access, for instance, so it moves, or they find something on the CAT scans and you know, things move in that sense. That might be a bad example, but you know what I mean. With the life cycle of a train, is it not, I'm going to oversimplify here and you can just tell me all the reasons why this is ridiculous. Surely you know how old the train is, you know how many miles it's done, it's booked in for a refurb in year X. Why would that change then? You know it's coming up in 2 years' time because it's 20 years old and it needs refurbishing. Isn't that obvious and it should just be the same date?
Yeah. Sounds good to me.
Are we in the territory of the Secretary of State or the Department for Transport saying, is there any chance you could sweat them for another couple of years?
I might be being a bit naughty asking that question, Jenny. So do tell me if that's too controversial for you to answer that. But
the question is there an issue sometimes where politically, where money's been tight, people have been asked if they can make their fleet last a little bit longer, which A, if they'd intimated to you that they were going to be coming to you for some work and then a minister pops up and says, but the Treasury says we've got the money this week, that throws everything into the skip. But also, yeah, how can you plan when maintenance schedules are being delivered by politicians, not by engineers?
Money is one part of it. But then I also think, this is how it appears. I'm not in the room where these conversations are having, but from our perspective, and I say I've got like a community of SMEs that are friends and things, sort of feels like they don't know the long-term plan. So you get some fleets changing on, like, not knowing who the operator is going to be, or it can be set to be that operator and then we're not going to have that fleet of trains, send them to a field. Well, actually get them out of the field, we'll take half of them. And this constant it feels like they haven't got clarity on the long-term plan.
And I suppose this, let's be optimistic for a minute and say, so maybe this is something GBR can help with, you'd hope, because if they're going to set a long-term strategy and everybody knows what the roadmap is, this could be an opportunity, yeah? But looking at the negative side of what we've had for the last 30 years, I suppose, in the privatised railway, the individual brands and the strength of those brands has got to be part of the problem, hasn't it? Because everybody wants their colour of seats, everybody wants their colour of carpet. If the trains all looked the same, if they were just all the same colour,
work could get done.
It could, couldn't it?
It would become more of a maintenance activity then.
Yeah.
It would go like you've just depicted lovely there, to go, all right, this is due. Let's do it, because it is the same. And you wouldn't be going, oh, well, actually, I don't know if I want to paint that blue, because it might not be that operator. And the decision is held up by the individuality.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the future, as far as we know, we're still going to have individual operating brands, aren't we? We're still going to have that.
For a while, at least, yes.
For quite some time, anyway. Yeah. And, well, I don't think I've heard anybody saying that GBR is going to do away with it entirely, because they quite like things like LNER, don't they? LNER makes a lot of money for the Treasury because it is LNER and it's red and it's, you know, they like that. Yes. So I can't see that changing massively in the next.
But even if they don't change actually the names, one of the things they said when they announced this grand plan to Great British Railways was the trains will be more comfortable. So if they roll up to you, if the department rolls up to you and says, okay, here's a fleet of trains that are due to be refurbished, we want them to be more comfortable, that's not actually just an easy answer, isn't it? You guys can't just say, ah, yes, well, as part of the thing, we'll just make them more comfortable. That's more complicated than maybe some politicians might believe, just, and you don't make them more comfortable by saying so anyway, but it's quite a thing, isn't it?
There's a very interesting read, the passenger comfort document at an RSSB document that lists all of the things that define passenger comfort, from the ergonomics to the bend of the knee to the lumbar to the density of the foam. There's lots of things can go into it and how you measure passenger comfort.
I've never read that.
Should
document.
Read it.
Sounds like a good read.
But, those should be on display at a station, because it would explain to passengers a lot, you know, while they're waiting for their delayed train.
You are comfortable.
Yes.
We're telling you you're comfortable because the measurements. Well, that was what I was just thinking, was surely it's quite subjective, and that you can write it all down, what you say is, you know, healthy or whatever, you know, inverted commas, healthy for you. But they did kind of do that. I don't think they had that document out, but previous podcast guest Robin Davies had a seat on show at Sheffield Station, didn't he, for one of his new trains, to have people come and have a sit and kind of give their feedback on, do you think it's comfortable or not? I wonder if they should have had the leaflet or the report next to it to say, but RSSB says it's comfortable.
Yeah, and it has to comply with all these things. So before you just say whether you like it or not, read all the things that we have to work to. Mind you, I mean, with those seats, the trains will be so old by that they'll be refurbishing them before they come into service. But
they'll be reverse engineering the parts for them.
Another discussion. They're only 4 years late. Yeah, anyway. Right. And obviously, if somebody said, well, I want my seats to recline just a bit more because we've gone through a trend of them being a bit too upright, that sometimes means you've got to spread them out differently, doesn't it? Because otherwise the recline is in the nose of the person behind. So you can't just say, we can find a way to make your seats slightly different. We found a way to re-engineer them, because you've got to go back and say, you're going to lose 4 seats a train or whatever. Are you okay with that?
And this capacity has taken precedent, and the other things to make any changes like that around PRM requirements or persons of reduced mobility and what the pitch has to be. But also then you'd have to do the crashworthiness testing if that was in a reclined position. So change isn't easy, is it?
It isn't.
In the railway.
So something that probably helps with all this uncertainty and this change and what have you is the people you have in your wonderful SME. So we sort of trailed this, didn't we, when we spoke to you very late at night at the Women in Rail Awards, that one of the really impressively unique things, and I think it is pretty unique about Diamond Rail Services, is the mix of diversity that you have. So tell us a bit about what your business looks like from the inside then.
So our director team is 5 people, and they are 3 women and 2 men on our director's board. We then have 5 managers, 3 are men, 2 are women. So straight away within just the management
stuff.
Team.
Yeah,
50-50 straight away. And then our shop floor team are a really good mix. So they are in a little bit gender specific roles, which bugs me. But we have got sewers and seamstresses, and they are the ladies.
Do they still call them seamstresses? That seems... Do they? Oh, interesting.
You can't call them seamers because that's a cricket thing. So you've got to think of a new...
What else would you call them? Stitchers.
Yeah, we can just throw into this, good. By the way, that I have owned my own sewing machine for at least 20 years, and I'm the only one in our family that knows how to hem curtains and
the recovered. Oh, you a seamstress, too. So, I didn't know
A, I need a title, but B, you know...
Do you want a job?
Well, you know, if
help
this,
me EDI.
If this doesn't go well, I'll be in touch.
You can help Jenny Stats. She can have a fella in the seamstress team.
You have got no male seamstresses.
I'll be one of those home workers. You deliver a bundle of things, I'll sew them and send them back. So, but no, I mean, you know, seriously, yes, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because of those skills, some just refuse to become more diverse because just tradition is locked in somewhere about what people want to be and not be.
Yes. And then I've got a team of men who do my more dirtier work, you know, getting oily, greasy, doing the driver's seat overhaul, taking horrible old seats. We recently started jobs doing jet washing and polishing of freight units. So we have offered that for the ladies to go and do it. And again, they don't want to. So it does fall into gender-specific roles. But on the paper, I think I'm like 60-40 split.
Yeah. And do you think those gender-defined roles, as they seem to naturally, as you say, have become in your business? I know you're involved in Women in Rail stuff and passionate. You are passionate about diversity in the industry. But do you think there is a sort of, that's as good as it's going to get? Because some roles just maybe are naturally more one way or the other, or is it something you're actively trying to change in your business?
You can't force it. And by actively, I think all you can do is give people opportunity. Uh-huh. So if any of the chaps wanted to learn to sew, of course, there isn't a rule that's it's a natural occurring. So all you can do is offer it up. Like when we're going to site a jet wash and polish, we said, do any of the ladies want to go? And they came to the first couple of meetings to learn what it was going to be about. And then they of their own accord went, no, that's not for me, thank you. Okay. So I think as long as you're given opportunity, that's all you can do. It doesn't feel particularly active.
No, but I think that's, as a woman and as a feminist, to me, you know, equality is about opportunity. It's not about making people do one thing or the other. It's about, are all of these opportunities equally open to
available.
Me? That's equality, because, you know, it's about choices, isn't it? And that's what it's supposed to be about.
Of course.
I mean, it would be lovely to think that you got some male stitchers. I'm going to go with stitchers. I can't think of a better word. Stitchers and some female jet washers, but hey, like you say, you can't force it.
I'm going to have to watch Coronation Street. I haven't watched it for years, but I know in the
there was a fella in the knicker factory. What did he refer to himself as?
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back through every episode now. I'll see you in a couple of years.
Seamstress does sound like a female word, doesn't it? What do you call a male seamstress?
Yeah,
sounds like a joke as well.
It does
it?
Sound like a joke. But we need to find out.
Seamster.
That doesn't sound right, though, does it? No,
right.
We have to do some research on that.
Okay, competition time again here. Write in if you can think of a new word. Back in the real world for a moment from that digression. When you are advertising for roles or recruiting, are you finding that you're getting applications from right across society, or are there people that still perceive some of the things that you do as a little bit, well, this isn't something that I would do naturally or whatever?
I'd say the percentage is really low of when we get a CV across the desk and go, oh, that's different. You know, we also recruit through agencies for vehicle builders to do like modifications on trains. And we were recruiting a couple of months ago and we got a female vehicle builder. And it was lovely to see that.
Yeah.
And then it was to interview her fairly and to not kind of, I wouldn't also use that as a pro, like, you know, oh, give her the job because it means we've got.
Yeah,
it's really difficult, though, because my brain would go there to go, I would like that person on my team. And actually, they weren't successful, unfortunately. And you have to kind of.
Still has to be the right person for the job at the end of the day, doesn't it?
And look at it.
That's the most important thing. And I guess maybe even that's more important, dare I say it, for an SME, because those margins of error are so much smaller for you. So you can't take any passengers on board. You've got to have everybody productive, top of their game.
We're not ticking boxes.
Yeah, whereas, I don't know, not that I'm saying one of the biggest suppliers do this, but maybe they've got more scope to take a bit more of a risk, maybe, on trying to kind of engineer that situation.
Yeah, they could. Yes, they could.
Mm. Well, you don't want a warranty claim coming in from the company you've worked for, and they say, well, half the seats are falling apart, but it was a lovely person we recruited and we felt so proud to get them on the team. They can't actually mend seats, but we were so happy to take them.
And we ticked a box because we had a female.
But in terms
you
of...
You said I had to be diverse. So I got all these unskilled people to do this job. So.
But in terms of what they're doing, when you finish doing a job, do they get out and see the thing working again? Do you say, go and ride on the train and see your work with the people appreciating it?
Well, that's a good question. So, Southeastern example, for instance, have any of your team from Sheffield had a chance to go and see those trains, you know, operating on the network?
So there was a core team from Sheffield who were there fairly frequently and they saw it. And a lot of the managers went down. It was a real showcase for us. And if we did recruit anybody, but no, we didn't give the opportunity for any of the shop floor. It would have been a lovely day out and to show. I'm trying to think how I would work that. It's a good idea. We have a lot of team comms.
Yeah.
And so I would share with them perhaps clips or feedback. You know, if I get stakeholder feedback, it goes to all of the team and can say, look, did you realise you were part of
this
great feedback? Or if there's an article or, you know, we can share it from that perspective. But I'm not sure how practical it is to put a coach on from Sheffield.
I sort of get where Tony's coming from asking it. Where my mind went is that it's another example of, not just in the rail industry, I'm sure there's examples of this in lots of different industries, where these people behind the scenes do something that's actually really important, you know.
Yes, and they've no idea really.
And then they don't see it. You know, they don't get to enjoy it. But the unsung heroes of train.
I did have them. We did a job a couple of years ago for a first class provider. And my daughter would sometimes come into work with us. Absolutely not underage employment or slave labour, I promise. But
just balancing, you know, being a working mum.
To be that clear, she got paid a fortune actually. But one of the things she did was help count these covers. So when we were doing like the piles, and we made these headrest covers, and she was putting them in a pile. And the best thing was then travelling on that train with her to go, look, you did that. She went, brain was blown.
Oh,
she
that's
was like,
so lovely.
Oh my God, that's the ones that we did. And that transference of that. So, that was nice.
I think it's quite powerful, isn't it? If you can make it happen, Jenny, we've taken up loads of your time. I know you've got lots to do and we promised we would give you a bit of time back because you're a busy lady. That has been so interesting and such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
We'll probably end up getting you back when we get all the questions in, saying, tell us about the sewing machines or whatever. But no, seriously, and I think there's some food for thought there for people who are creating the new era of railways as well.
And if we get a raft of CVs from male stitchers who may have a different name for themselves that I don't know, then we'll send them your way.
Absolutely, yeah. And you're both more than welcome to come to Sheffield to see us. We're actually building a steam train on site as well.
Oh, wow.
A Pengus. Can tell you more about that if you like, or you can come and see the site. It's really cool.
Field trip.
Yeah, absolutely.
Get in.
Field trip to Sheffield.
Thank you very much. That was a fascinating one.
That was a bit different, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I love the behind the scenes stuff that we get to chat about.
We should go on a field trip and we should take some photos of them seamstressing or seaming.
I'm definitely going to have to find out what the word is. I hope somebody emails in because it's going to just bother me now. Anyway, thank you for listening again, and hopefully you enjoyed that as much as we did. If you have any thoughts on what you've just heard, any feedback, any questions, any suggestions of the collective noun for male people who sew things together, please do email in the usual address, contact@pwllines.com. That's contact@pwllines.com.
We'll be back soon with yet more. We've still got a queue of people that we want to talk to or that want to talk to us. So we'll be back with more very soon.